Welcome to the most listened to radio show at 9:05 a.m. on AM 910 WJCW right at this minute. So I'm not claiming anything there that's not true. Unlike most car dealer advertising that I've been seeing lately. Lots of claims of things that are not exactly true. This is a battle that I have faced over the years. There are advertising rules. We've talked about them. I'm looking at them right now on my computer. Advertising guidelines of the Tennessee Motor Vehicle Commission. I've broken a few of these before they were actually laws or rules, in terms of the way you price vehicles. Not referring actually, for example, to the MSRP, which is a pretty much a common guide that most customers weigh one vehicle to another. By the way, this is Lenny Lawson, the Car Guru, and I'm on here every day except Saturday and Sunday, talking some about the car business and cars and buying and selling and trading and servicing cars and things that you should do and not do and watch out for. But the advertising thing is a kind of a moving target, folks. I've tried to coach you on, what to believe and what not to believe. A lot of what you see online is accurate because it's monitored by the factories. If a dealer doesn't behave online when it comes to his pricing model, then they can lose money. That's pretty good incentive. You can actually lose advertising co-op funds if you don't advertise it correctly. Although, you may say that, well, if you advertise in a way that's deceptive, you'll get more customers to come in and buy cars from you. And so what if you have to give up $10,000 or $15,000 in advertising co-op refunds when you can make $50,000 by deceiving people? So how are you being deceived? Well, a lot of the offers that you see as far as minimum trade allowances, we'll give you $8,000 minimum for your trade-in. That is such a come-on that is so blatantly deceptive because you don't know what they're giving you $8,000 off of. What if they jack up the price $8,000 and say, hey, we'll give you $8,000 off? Then they're still getting full price, aren't they? There you go. That's what you're seeing. And, it's not just dealers around here, dealers across the country. That was kind of a drug that a lot of dealers got onto was a minimum trade allowance. And, you're just looking at part of the equation. One plus two equals three. If you just have three equals or two equals three, well, that's not true. If you add the one plus to it, it makes sense. And so what happened? Does that analogy work? I think it does. So if you have a situation where a dealer is offering a minimum trade allowance or the other come on we've talked about is the making you an offer on your vehicle subject to an appraisal, subject to condition, subject to. What does subject to mean? It means they can change their mind and not give you what they're advertising. So fine print is important, reading it, but sometimes the fine print is deceptive as well. When you're on a website and you're looking at a car dealer website, if you see a price, then many times there will be a number, a reference number, like a 1 or a 2 or a letter, A, B, C, or a asterisk or several asterisks in a row. Aren't you impressed with the way I say asterisk? And if you click on that, it's supposed to take you to the disclaimer, which tells you that, what are the conditions under which you can get that particular offer. If the disclaimer has things in it that says, for example, that the price does not, no other discounts or incentives can be used on this price, then, you need to really think about that before you jump in your car and drive down to the store. My recommendation is pretty much the same, is go through the Business Development Center, go through the online contact, and keep it nonverbal at first. I like the idea of emailing back and forth, text messaging back and forth if you want to give up your cell phone number. Maybe not always the wisest thing to do, but your email, just email back and forth until you, you know, refine the information on a particular car that you're interested in. Make sure that they have the car in stock, obviously. Make sure that there's no deposits on it, and then start your deal, understanding that the car may be sold by one of the other 20 salespeople that work at that dealership, and the person in the BDC, Business Development Center, may not know that the vehicle is sold. But start your dialogue with a new car dealer today. This is the way you do it. You do it online. If you go into the store, you really don't know what you're going to get. Now, I have worked really hard at my dealership, Gateway Ford and Gateway Nissan in Greenville, to train our salespeople to really know the product really well and to understand the process that we use, which is very consumer-friendly, and to apply that process to everybody. But still, I mean, you're dealing with a human being, and they don't always, let's just say they don't always follow the plan. You'll find occasionally the worst salesperson you can run into is somebody who has been and worked at maybe three or four different dealerships and jumped ship several times. Those people are after the money strictly. They don't care about relationships. They don't care that, about deception. That's how they've figured out to make their living, and they've been caught several times and fired for it. Fard, as we say around here. And there are some stores that don't fire those people. They celebrate. As a matter of fact, they look for those people because they know that they can make them the most money. Now, there's nothing wrong with money, right? It's the love of money. It's deceiving people, to get their money. That's the problem. And that's what you have to watch out for. That's why I say when you're getting ready to buy a new car, used car, go through the BDC. And if you don't have access to the internet, then call them and speak to somebody in the Business Development Center. You'll usually get a nice little female or male. It could be a man that is actually working in the BDC. It's not uncommon at all. I've just encountered more females working in that office. And, sometimes they will know as much about the product as the salespeople do. Sometimes they do not. But they can start the process, and you can really whittle it down from a communication standpoint and know what you're getting. Because a lot of this stuff is deceptive. And I hate that for you. I really do. If you're interested in buying a new vehicle and you're questioning whether it's a real deal, just take a screenshot of the advertised price and the disclaimer and send it to me. I'll look at it. I'll tell you, what to expect. If it's from certain dealerships, I'll know it's deceptive, and I'll know that you're going to be disappointed, if you really pay attention. But there are most of the dealerships, if you send me something from, certain stores that I know about, then I know it's going to be right. It's going to be legitimate. And, all the dealers, they know who the crooks are. They do. The honest ones do, and the crooks know too. You just have to, know somebody who knows. And that's me, the car guru, Lenny Lawson. 423-552-2020. You can take a screenshot with your computer, or you can just, you know how to do that if you are an iPhone user. I don't know how you Android people do it, but I know you can take a screenshot and you know how to text it to me. And I'll look at it, and I'll tell you what to expect. Doesn't have to be from me, If you want to take a picture of mine, go ahead. But if it's some other dealership in the Tri-Cities, I'll be glad to, or in the world, I'll be glad to tell you what to expect on that. And then the other things you need to do as far as your trade-in is concerned and figuring out what it's going to be worth, that's important. Do you know, I'm going to go through a decade when I was born, and I'm going to talk about some of these companies that many of you have probably never heard of, and they were the top-selling brands in my decade of the 50s, and we'll do that here in just a minute. I would like to have been a teenager or a young adult in the 50s. I don't, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like a little bit more innocent time. It seems like that people were, I don't know, were friendlier. Those of you who, you know, were teenagers or young adults in the 50s may say, no, it wasn't that way at all. It was just as bad as it is now. But that's not what my parents told me. They told me it was a better time, more innocent time. It certainly was a period of great transition in this country, you know, with the advent of the interstate highway system, you know, Eisenhower, you know, came up with the concept after seeing the unbelievable highway system in Germany and what Adolf Hitler was able to do as far as the Autobahn was concerned. And we just didn't have that here. You know, we had Route 60 as a two-lane road. I'm sure there were some four-lane roads and stuff back in the 50s, but the interstate system where you had limited access was not there, but it was coming and developed fairly rapidly. But there were a lot of differences. You know, cars were bigger, bulkier, American cars, that is, domestic cars, and that's what was selling in this country. Chevrolet was the number one selling brand in the 1950s. They sold 13,419,000 cars and trucks during the 50s. I guess you can guess who was number two at that time. It was Ford. Ford was number two. But I would have never guessed what number three was. By the way, Ford sold 12,282,000 vehicles in the 50s. And the next one didn't sell half as many. They sold 5,600,000. And it wasn't Oldsmobile or Pontiac or Dodge or Chrysler or Cadillac or any of those others. It was actually Plymouth. Yep. You know, Plymouth was an affordable car back then. And it was popular. Unlike it became late, you know, before they finally decided to pull the plug on Plymouth. The number five best-selling car was Buick. And then Oldsmobile, and then Pontiac. So you had Chevrolet, of General Motors is concerned, you had Chevrolet, Buick, Oldsmobile, and Pontiac in the top 10. And then came Mercury at 2.5 million, Dodge at 2.4 million, and then a brand that no longer exists. This is the first one. Well, I take that back. Plymouth no longer exists either. Its main company does, except now it's owned by the French. Italians had it for a while. The Germans had it for a while. Do you realize that the Chrysler Corporation over the last 25 years has been owned by Americans, and then it was owned by, the Germans, Mercedes-Benz bought them, and then it was owned, and then they got away from them, and then they filed bankruptcy. And then it was owned by the Italians, Fiat bought them, and now Chrysler Corporation, that includes Jeeps, folks. Yes, your Jeep was an Italian, owned by an Italian company. Well, now guess what? It's French. It's owned by Peugeot. So the French, Peugeot Renault, they own the Chrysler Corporation. Not Renault, I'm sorry. That's Peugeot. It all sounds kind of like the same, but it's not. So Mercury was in that group, and then Dodge, then Studebaker. So the Studebaker was an interesting brand. I mean, they were around since the 20s, or they actually, even before that, because they actually made wagons and coaches before they had put motors in them. But Studebaker sold 1.3 million cars and no longer exists. Packard was another one. Packard Company was made some of the most incredible cars in the 30s. In the 50s, they had kind of lost their way a little bit, weren't that special. But Packard, then Chrysler, then Cadillac, then another one that went away, Nash, then DeSoto. My dad used to drive DeSotos. His dad, his first car, my dad's dad had an interesting history. His first part of his, as far as my family was concerned, was not good. He left my dad and mom, or dad and grandmother, when my dad was six, and never saw my dad again until my dad was 18. Now, they reconciled and got back together, and things were good after that. But he was the number one salesperson, Chevrolet salesperson, in the city of Detroit in 1932. I guess if you can sell cars during the Great Depression in Detroit, that's pretty good. Maybe only sold four, but he was number one anyway. But that's where the Lawson heritage started as far as the car business. But, you know, my dad, like I say, reconciled with his dad and had a good relationship until he passed away. But Nash and then DeSoto, he gave my, again, my dad got a DeSoto, kind of got off track there just a second. I do that occasionally. And my dad totaled that DeSoto. He hit a road grader that was parked. Yeah. Not a good thing to hit. My dad was lucky to survive that accident, but had insurance and got another DeSoto. That was before he became a Chevy guy in 1956 when I was born. And then Rambler sold 641,000 during the decade. Hudson, you know, that's a cool brand. Have you ever seen a Hudson? They were pretty, the Hudson Hawk. And, you know, one of the cars, that movie, the Cars movie, I think the main character, not the main character, but one of the main characters was a Hudson. What was his name? Doc. Yeah. And then Lincoln. Here's another couple names that you may not have heard of. Kaiser. Kaiser sold 224,000 vehicles. And Henry J. Wouldn't that be something to have a company right now that was selling cars named Henry J. And then Edsel, Imperial, Willys, which didn't just sell Jeeps. They sold other things as well. Then Continental, which was a separate brand at that time. And then Fraser, or Fraser, F-R-A-Z-E-R. And so the total estimate for vehicles sold in the 50s, excluding any import brands, that's another thing, you just don't see any of those, was the total was 57,900,000. No imported cars in that list, because they just weren't, you know, there weren't a lot of them. I mean, back in the 50s, Porsche was selling cars in the United States. Mercedes-Benz was. You know, Volkswagen, obviously. MG, you know, the MG cars were very popular. The TD and the TF and the TC, they were all very old design of cars. Looked like a car from the 30s or the 20s that they were still selling, that same kind of body style, beautiful cars. But there were a lot of import cars at the time. But, you know, the Americans just really, they weren't interested in them. And they didn't really sell very well. And that was, we owned the market back then. So what happened to General Motors and Ford and Chrysler? Well, they got lazy. And it took a while. The 60s was still a wonderful time for the big three. I remember in 1965, Chevrolet sold 1 million Impalas. You know, Impala was the best-selling car throughout the 60s. Ford did pretty well with the Galaxies. But, you know, the Chevrolet kind of dominated a lot of the high-volume number. General Motors was on top. And then the 70s came, and the oil embargo, and the game changed. We'll be back here in just a minute. Now, I'm a child of the 70s. Well, really, I was a child in the 60s, but I was a teenager in the 70s. And I remember those days very well. I remember the crap that we were selling. But we didn't think it was crap at the time. Can I say crap on the radio? I guess I just did. I was just the problems that we had with the integration of emission controls. So in the early 70s, you know, we had the oil embargo and all that stuff. And so gas mileage became important. Emissions also became important. The EPA was formulated and came up with all these guidelines for automakers, and they said, you know, you've got to reduce your tailpipe emissions. So they did. They put smog pumps on cars and just choked them down to where they had very little horsepower. I remember when a Corvette had under 200 horsepower, in the 70s. And so cars didn't run good. We had, I was a service advisor back then early in that decade of the 70s, and we had so many people coming in complaining about hesitation and, you know, just vehicles not accelerating smoothly, not starting right. The salvation was fuel injection. You know, when fuel injection came along, that changed the way fuel was delivered into the engine and made a much more precise fuel and air mixture. And then they started to figure out, well, you know, we can adjust timing. We can change the timing of valves, when valves open and close. And all of this computer technology came to the forefront. And but, you know, what really hurt the domestic industry was just the whole concept of planned obsolescence. That's where vehicles were designed to self-destruct at about 100,000 miles. And the Japanese didn't look at it that way. They built stuff to last, and they stole the passenger car market from domestic producers, you know. And now you see Ford Motor Company and General Motors, we don't sell cars. I mean, we have a Mustang, but, you know, there's no Taurus anymore. There's no Fusion. Chevrolet doesn't have an Impala or Monte Carlo or anything like that anymore, because buying habits have changed. But still, you know, you got Nissan still sells the Sentra and the Versa and the Altima and the Maxima. And so, but the Japanese started building cars like the Honda Accord and the Civic and the Toyota Corolla. And these cars lasted a long time, ran good, performed well, got great fuel economy, and the American cars did not. And then American car companies were building Vegas and Pintos and then Monzas and Granadas and stuff that people just did not want. And so they lost the market. And here we are today. And really, today, it's a level playing field, folks. I used to say, you know, the quality difference was obvious. Japanese cars were better. German cars were better. But that's not the case anymore. Some of you may disagree. But the level of quality with any car, you can go to a Chevy dealership and buy an Equinox, and it's just about as good as a Mercedes ML350. The quality is there, you know, everybody. But now the perception is not that way. But the reality is that it's a level playing field now. And that's good for consumers like you. Well, folks, that's the end of this show. I will be with you again on Monday morning, and I appreciate you listening to this edition of My Car Guru, and we will see you then. Be safe.